I'm Helen Reed, and I joined the Evening Post in 1959 after graduating with an English degree from Bristol University. And I hadn't a clue what I wanted to do for a living. I'd never considered journalism. And I went down to the Labour Exchange, and they said, "Have you thought about being a journalist?" And it turned out that Richard Hawkins, who was the editor of the Evening Post at the time, was new to editing and didn't know about the Press Gazette. So he told them, Labour Exchange, he'd got a vacancy, and they sent me along and I got the job. And I had a hard time joining the union. I wanted to right from the start, but they wouldn't let me in because of my unconventional background. I had no training. It wasn't usual to have graduates. And I had to sort of prove myself for about 2 years that I was earning a living from writing before they would let me in.
So what sort of an editor was he to work under?
In some ways, very enlightened, very keen on culture. I mean, he had Tom Stoppard working for him at one stage, and so he got a great arts page going in the Western Daily Press. But he wasn't really a newsman, and I don't think his heart was in it.
So what happened then? Maybe you could just take us back to those days when you first started. Whereabouts was the paper, for a start? Where was it based?
Right, the Evening Post then was in a terrible building in Silver Street in Broadmead, and we worked in a room that had holes in the floors where rats had chewed it, and we had those lamps and tubes going all over the room, and copy boys running about, and it was...
Those tubes, what are they?
Lamps and tubes where you sent copy down to the typesetters, to the printers, pneumatic tubes. You filled a little canister with your copy, your typewritten copy, and it whizzed through the tubes down the building. One thing that was very noticeable was that it was almost all male. There were three women working. There was me doing general stuff and two women's editors, one for each paper. And that stayed true for a good long time. I mean, nowadays, I mean, there are probably more women than men, but then you were really on your own. And I think that made a great difference because the pay structure. I worked for years for the Western Daily Press, not knowing that I was getting several thousand a year less than the men, because Eric Price, who was the editor of the Western Daily Press, used to tell me that men had got mortgages and children to support, and I didn't need the money, and they did. So theoretically we had equal pay, it was far from unequal, and that sort of led to the first attempt to get a house agreement, which I was very much part of.
So what initially drew you to being part of the union? Why did you think it was something that was worth joining?
Well, I felt we had to act as a group and we had to have common objectives, and you know, nobody ever talked about pay and conditions. It was all, you know, you went to see the editor on your own and you did your own deals, and it soon struck us as being very unfair that if you did the job, there should be a rate for that job. And we gradually got together a pay claim, which came as quite a shock to the management. I mean, they were Walter Hawkins and the Evening Post directors were very nice, benevolent people, and very civilised to work for, but they didn't really consider that we had rights. I mean, we... and the first negotiations were quite difficult.
So how did the management take that when you sort of presented this fait accompli, you know, a pay request or pay demand on the table?
Well, it wasn't a demand. We wanted a proper pay structure that rewarded you for what you were doing, not who you were. And I think it was just a new idea. They weren't difficult or unpleasant about it. And gradually, when it settled down, we got negotiations going every year very amicably. It worked quite well.
So just take us back again to the sort of building you were working in and working with the printers as they were in those days. What was it like for those youngsters coming into the business now? Can you just explain what it was like working with the older, much older technology and in quite difficult conditions?
Well, yes, it was an awful building with terrible dark staircases with holes in them, and the printers were really sort of raced apart. You had to be very careful not to upset them, not to pick up bits of type and so on and ask silly questions. really we didn't have much relationship with the printers. It was like going back into the Industrial Revolution, the hot metal type setting and so on. And I don't think we realised its days were numbered until we moved over to the new building, which we're in now, in 1972 or 1, I think it was.
So was the move to the new building part of the buy-up of the shares in the old Evening Post by the Associated Newspapers, the Daily Mail, or not?
No, it wasn't. It was still Bristol United Press. It was still the old management that started the paper. Gradually the shares got sold off and they fought it hard. I mean, it was a family business and they loved it, but there wasn't a son to take over. And I don't know, their ethos became old-fashioned. I think they made money, but not as much as they could have done if they were managed by somebody like Northcliffe.
How did the move to the new building go?
Well, that was nice. I mean, it was such a luxury after what we'd had. We had such a terrible building. Everyone liked it. It was very luxurious. But what was looming was new technology, of course. And I was part of the... I was, in fact, deputy FOC of our chapel when we went on strike in 1978. In the winter of 1978, there was snow on the ground. We had a caravan outside and a brazier and the police every night.
So what brought about the strike? What ran up? Could you just take us up to that? What happened?
Well, it was that the management wanted to introduce computers, obviously, the new technology. And so for once, we and the printers were all on the same side because they were resisting it. And really, it was to get paid for making the change that we went out for 6 weeks, I think it was. And it was pretty solid. We had some IOJ members who went on working, and they had a very nasty time, I can tell you, because the spirit of that strike was just fantastic. We were really fired up, all of us.
So you were galvanised really behind the idea of stopping computers being introduced, but surely it was going to be inevitable.
No, we knew it was inevitable, but we wanted to be paid the rate for doing it. I mean, not be paid typewriting rates. The key to all this, of course, was the printers. I mean, we'd never have had any stop the paper coming out. We didn't really very often stop it, but we delayed it. But the printers were absolutely key to this. And they were pretty good, pretty solid, because they were facing big job losses. So every day we got the printers to delay going in by chatting them up with giving them a case. And all the van drivers, when the papers came out, we got the police to allow 3 minutes each. And since there were a great many vans, that delayed the paper quite a lot. But, the people left inside the building managed to get a paper of sorts out.
Yeah, maybe you could just describe what the newspaper was like under the strike conditions. Was it just all adverts and a few little bits of wire copy?
There was lots of wire copy and big pictures and so on. But, I mean, they got a paper out. It was a smaller paper than usual, but, they did.
And so how did that resolve itself?
In the end, they caved in and agreed to talks. And we all got quite handsome increases in exchange for being trained.
And was that under the old management still?
Yes, it was still under the old management, yes.
Well, I mean, we were talking about the same newspaper, but obviously the character of the management is quite different. Can you maybe talk about that a bit?
Oh, I don't think I should, actually, because I'm not on the staff and I don't really see it day to day. I mean, I just get the impression that it's much, much harsher and rigid about rules and so on. You put a notice up, it's taken down, that sort of thing. With the changeover from the old Evening Post to being owned by Northcliffe is most noticeable in the fact that it's a big monolithic organisation and you don't know people anymore. We knew the owners, we knew the directors and all the admin staff and so on. Now it's all distant. And, they don't know who you are. And that's a big difference. But you actually had some personal relationship with the people who owned the paper. And that's gone, I think.
Would you have any advice for youngsters just coming into the business? I mean, I know it's a difficult question, but for someone just starting out in journalism and the way it is today, what tips have you got for youngsters?
go out and talk to people, don't rely on the internet and the phone, I would say. That's what's so noticeable, is that when I was a young reporter, the room would be empty because we'd be all out on stories. Now the room is full and they're all on the phone or you know, looking at Google. And really, there's nothing to beat going out and meeting people. If you want to get the story and the flavour of a story, you must go out.
How did you make the transition into the features side from doing news?
I deputised for the women's editor while she was on holiday, and the editor liked my stuff and took me on as a feature writer.
And what's the difference between news and features, do you think? What's the quality? Do you enjoy it more?
Oh, much more, yes. I mean, you can use much more imagination. You're not so hidebound by rules and facts and so on. You can use your opinions, which is much, much more. And talk to people on a different level. When you're just chasing facts, it's not the same as getting at their inner feelings and so on. I think one tip, if you're interviewing a celeb, is to do your homework very carefully. I used to interview authors quite often, and they would be astounded and they'd say, "You actually read the book," which apparently is unusual. Things like that. I used to do a lot of sort of big set pieces, like the Princess Di's wedding, and that was an ordeal and a half, I can tell you, because no laptops, no mobiles. So we had a London office as a base. But you had to, you know, tear between Westminster Abbey. Was it Westminster or was it St Paul's? Must have been Westminster, I can't remember. And then tear down Fleet Street, type it all out, and get someone to put it on the wire for you. Whereas, you know, now you can practically do it instantly on the spot. It was hard body work, I must say.
For young people getting into the business now, do you think the union has still got a role?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, more than ever, I think, yeah. Because with these big employers, with their monolithic structures and ways of doing things, you know, and they really do not want to know. They see it as subversive to join a union, and they can get away with things that they shouldn't get away with.
So what sort of thing? I mean, you know, if you're not in a union, how is it going to affect you, do you think, if you're not actually part of the union? Is it really going to make a difference?
You're going to have to make deals on your own, and you're in the dark about what other people are getting, what other rates are, you know, conditions and so on. I think you should always negotiate from the strength of a large group.